Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on this weekend edition, 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. President Trump and Angela Merkel from Germany, they're going to meet. What are they going to discuss? We've got some items I'll probably be talking about. How to have more engaging conversations in your everyday life. That's something probably people would like to do. We've got a good write-up about that. And also one of our own here, Imperial Academy senior Caleb Hirma. He won a writing contest for the entire state of Oklahoma. He's in the national contest now. We're going to talk to him as well. That and more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. How are you gentlemen doing?
Fantastic.
Excellent.
Doing pretty good.
Good. Abraham, your tie, I just happened to notice it. It reminds me of the packaging from those cookies.
Right. Scott's. Is it?
Yeah.
Shortbread?
Shortbreads. Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks exactly like that. Makes me hungry for cookies.
Well, actually, it's my school tie. I went to a military school in Canada,
uh-huh.
a public military school called Juneau Beach Academy, and this is the tartan of the Calgary Highlanders, the regiment there, and that's the school colors we had.
Got to be true to your school.
Yeah.
Didn't the Beach Boys say that?
Probably.
Somebody said
that. Juneau Beach Boys.
You guys are millennials. You don't know.
It's all tied together.
There's a lot of things going on. One of the things that's happening, President Trump and German Chancellor Angela Merkel are ready for some tough talk, they say, according to CNN Money, on trade and defense spending. And so here are some of the things I think they're going to talk about. Trade and jobs, NATO and defense spending, the future of the EU and Russia, and sanctions regarding them. So a lot of heavy topics there on the board. You know, you'd always like to be a fly in the room. Just to hear what they have to say about these different things, and it'll be interesting to see what comes of it.
Yeah, it would be interesting to hear some of those topics. Those are some pretty big ones. It's good to hear that there's no immigration talk. I think that would get the most heated response from both of them. Hopefully they can stay civil on some of these other things.
There is actually an article today about Erdogan from Turkey, and he's threatening to send, I forget how many it was, thousands of more refugees into Europe every month because he's mad at Europe. So there's this battle there between Turkey and Europe. And so I thought of that when you're talking about the immigration, because that is a big issue as well over there in Germany, of course. So those are some of the things that they're probably going to talk about. I mean, obviously, there's probably other things that we wouldn't know about, but these are some of the big issues. Probably one of the biggest ones is how much money is the U.S. going to give to NATO, and probably it's going to be less. So that means Germany's going to have to step up and do more, I think.
Yeah, I did see a new statistic released yesterday, I think, showing for 2017 the projected budgets of each major power, how much they're going to spend on the military. U.S. was $680 billion. It was three times that of China, which was number two. And I think Germany was between five and eight. I forget exactly which one, but they were right there. So depending on what these talks go, if the U.S. does pull out NATO funding, Germany will probably have to put in more. So that could potentially make Germany third or fourth greatest military power in the world. Never mind even some people thinking that Germany needs to become a nuclear country.
Right.
As well, so that these talks with Merkel could really set those wheels in motion, and it could be, groundbreaking.
Anyone else think that's a bad idea? Germany arming to the teeth? Any historical precedent of that not working out? It's funny. It's just funny how maybe people just kind of look at it, and they're like, oh, you know, okay, this is the way it goes now, but you don't have to go very far back to see what happened the last time, and I guess people think we're just so far advanced we could never get back into a war again. But meanwhile, war is on everybody's doorstep.
Yeah, that's the whole issue. Germany technically is capable of funding itself more in NATO. But the thing is, they do need to be supervised, or at least that was the idea back when America was so heavily involved or wanted to be so heavily involved. Now we're just kind of ceding control to Germany, and we don't really know how destructive that might be.
It's going to be interesting. So that's a meeting that's coming up here over the next few days there with President Trump and Angela Merkel. You know, there'll be a lot more about that, I'm sure, on the trumpet in the days ahead. China, of course, they ban a lot of websites. They've added Pinterest to the list of banned sites. If you're in China now, you can no longer access Pinterest. So that'll affect a lot of the ladies over there, I guess, because that's kind of women typically like that website.
You agree with that move, right, Abraham?
Yeah, I was thinking about moving to China now.
Yeah, too much time on Pinterest, huh? Yeah.
Oh, I just, I mean, for me personally, I just dislike Pinterest so much. But
he always used to see people on Pinterest during class.
Yeah, oh, I gotcha.
I just can't stand it. But it is very useful. My wife uses it to plan a lot of things. That part I think is good. But when you just spend your time looking at funny pictures and things like that and just can eat away your soul, that's the thing that gets to me, I guess.
Wow. Well, you agree then with China. They say one of the reasons that they're banning some of these isn't so much this like moral high ground. It's because they think they're just squeezing out competitors for their own versions of things. They've had a crackdown on Google, YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. It's helped domestic companies in China such as Baidu, Youku, Weibo, and Renren flourish. I don't know if I said those right. You guys on Renren?
No.
So they've got their own versions, and they think that's why they're doing it, is because they want to give their companies a better advantage. China has 731 million internet users. 95% of them have access on mobile devices. So that's a lot of folks checking it out.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I think this one story helps highlight the hypocrisy in the trade relationship between China and the United States, where China can ban a multi-million dollar American corporations, like internet-based corporations, going into China and making profits. But as soon as America wants to raise tariffs, China's like, well, that's an act of war. Like, well, I think China's been undermining American businesses in China for a long time. So it is a little unfair, but what is more, too, it's they're censoring outside cultures to where, I mean, on the Chinese version of Pinterest, probably the only picture on there is a picture of Mao that you can keep posting over and over again. Like, what are you going to be able to have on there? It's going to be things that glorify communism.
Abraham is salty.
I love it.
No, that's a really good point about how they're able to do things like that, and nobody really bats an eye at it. But if we did it, right, it'd be a big issue. It would be so bizarre to start a war over Pinterest.
Yeah.
But trying to explain it to future generations. What started that conflict? That was this website, it's Pinterest.
Yeah, the hypocrisy is definitely evident there. Like Abraham said, the fact that they can do to us exactly what they don't like us doing to them, and yet somehow that's totally fine. That really is a big part of this whole story.
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting to see that happening. We mentioned a couple, maybe it was even last week, that there was a little bit of concern maybe about the yellow fever in Brazil, and it's getting worse over there. Brazil yellow fever cases past 400. There's more than 130 dead. So whenever you have that high of a percentage of people dying, that's obviously very serious. An updated list published Thursday said that more than 900 other cases are under investigation. So just something to keep your eye on. Mosquitoes pass that around. And anytime mosquitoes are passing something, it's how are you going to prevent it? They're so irritating, so little, and they bite you even when you don't know it happened. So kind of a serious deal there, they say, because of the rainy season. It's popping up. So we'll have to keep our eye on the see what happens there in Brazil. And, of course, they are watching people that are traveling to and from those regions, because that's how it can kind of spread around.
Yeah, there's a lot of diseases that are really dangerous, but that one seems to strike the most fear in a lot of people, just because, obviously, with a disease, you can avoid the people who are infected normally. But with this one, you have to avoid the people who are infected plus the mosquitoes who are carrying it, too. How do you avoid mosquitoes? They're so tiny, you can hardly see them. Usually, you don't notice them until after you start itching, and so they've already gotten you by then.
Yeah, the worst thing is when you're trying to sleep and you hear that really high-pitched
so annoying
sound in your ear. it's unlike anything, and it's one of the most irritating sounds that you could ever hear. Some other headlines from today are there at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you stop and check that out. It's new and revised website, and a lot of great content there, and just a little bit of a different package, but more information too. And the top story today at thetrumpet.com is by Andrew Miller, Pornography Scandal Rocks U.S. Military. You probably have heard some about this. How widespread is this sex perversion, more so than you think? So that's a good write-up there. It's always tough. You start having men and women in the military together, and then more problems come from that. Not that it should happen, but it's it can happen because of the situation, so it's interesting to look at it.
Yeah, and you would think there were already probably some issues before women even joined with men being away from their families for so long, but now you add women in there, and it's like we're taking it up a notch. We're kind of making it really hard for these people to keep any morals in their lives when those types of things are all around them.
So that's it's just another weakening of the military, right? You have that corruption inside of it. So anyway, that's a feature piece there, an analysis piece at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you check that out, and the other headlines there today as well. If you guys rent homes, right? You don't own. Mm-hmm. I own.
Correct.
Yeah. I own. Wink, wink. I pay the bank. But
you will soon own.
I hope I own it. And so it's always tempting to do some renovations from time to time. And the thing that people always have to consider is the money you put into it, will you get that back? Is it a good renovation? So U.S. News has a write-up here. 6 home renovations you think will pay off but won't. So this, I guess, would depend on a lot of things, but this is their list anyway. They say, of course, it varies by project and location. You know, you could install something really nice in a bad neighborhood, and you're not going to get your money back on it. I think they call that outbuilding your neighborhood or something to that effect.
Right.
Where, yeah, it's a great place, but it's surrounded by places that aren't so great. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of build according to the neighborhood if you're hoping to get your money back. One of the things that does not get you your money back is if you add an in-ground pool. They can be nice, but you're not going to get your money back on it. Some people don't want pools because it's a hazard.
Mm. Interesting.
Well, especially in Oklahoma, the ground moves so much. I think most pools crack over time because the earthquakes, and just the ground's very mobile. So especially in Oklahoma, I think that's a problem.
Yeah.
But I don't see a whole lot of pools nowadays either. And if they are, there's little kiddie pools, and usually it's not even water in them. There's other things in them, like kids' toys or adults. But yeah, it's just I don't know, I guess different culture, or I guess they're just really expensive too.
Yeah, and pools are usually surrounded, like there's grass right up to the border of it. So, I mean, anytime the wind blows, a lot of dirt would get in there, and you mow your grass and all the clippings get in there just because it's level with the ground. So that, in a lot of ways, that would be kind of inconvenient.
Yeah, so and the upkeep and all that, it's quite a bit. So, and then I think the insurance rates are higher because you have to insure against problems with that. And then they leak sometimes, too. Another one that they say, if you put your money into this type of renovation, you probably won't get it back, is a gourmet kitchen renovation. Sorry, ladies. They say redoing your kitchen with high-end finishes and professional appliances might look great, but it won't yield nearly what you spent when you go to sell. You only get about 65.3% of your money back on it, they think. So you have to pay attention to that. Also, patio or deck. And then there again, it depends on what type you put in. If you put in a monstrous deck with an outdoor fire pit and all that, you would probably not get your money back on it. If it's just a general one, you might do okay.
It seems like in general, renting could actually save you some money, because usually you're not allowed to totally overhaul the whole place where you're staying. So if your wife gets an ambitious home renovation project, you're like, sorry, I mean, we're renting. We can't really do a whole lot with it. So that way, you don't spend all that time and money on it anyway.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it depends on if how good you are personally. Like, if you're able to make it yourself, well, maybe you can do okay. If you're hiring it out, and you've got to know that line, because if you think, I'm going to try this and it doesn't work, that's a bad deal. So sometimes you can do some things, sometimes you can't. Depends on your skill level. Another thing that actually doesn't help very much, they say, is adding a master suite, putting on another bedroom. They say probably not going to get your money back on that. Maybe 64.8% of it, potentially. Adding a bathroom doesn't help either. Same thing, 64.8%. And also installing new windows, which is something they always try to get you to do. And, of course, the selling point is it's going to save you with heating and air conditioning. It's going to take you a long, long time to get your money back on that. So I don't know. I'd be interested to see a list of things that do pay back, because most cases you just never get your money back on these things.
Yeah, well, especially if the housing market depreciates in value. But I guess what they say is location, location, location. I think as long as your house is in a good location, you'll probably get your money back no matter what you do on it. Maybe that's a big rule they go by as well.
Yeah, so kind of interesting. Thought it might be a helpful list for some people. The people that are halfway into those projects. Like,
yeah.
What?
Oh, no.
I'm sure they would have done their research. And you know what? If you don't care and you just want a nice thing and you can do it, that's probably the best reason to do it, not just to get your money back on it.
And sometimes it's smart to just buy a fixer-upper, because then that way the difference between what you bought compared to what you're later trying to sell would actually be pretty obvious, so you could actually sell the house for substantially more than what you bought it for.
Yeah, some people do that for a job. They're just particularly good at it, and they do that. You guys have probably heard of this state park in Arkansas. It's the state park where they have the diamonds. Have you heard of that place?
No.
You can go there and look for diamonds?
I don't think so.
Yeah, you can just roam around and look for diamonds, and they find a lot of them there. Arkansas teenager just found a 7.44 carat diamond, and he named it Superman. It's kind of a weird name for a diamond.
Yeah.
It's Crater of Diamonds State Park, and it bills itself as the world's only keep-what-you-find diamond site. You find it, it's yours.
Actually, yeah, you told me about it. That's the only reason I knew.
I think we maybe mentioned it months back or something. The young man's name is Khalil Langford. He's 14, and he's from Arkansas there. He spotted the rock while walking with his parents. These are just sitting there sometimes. It's not like they're digging around. Maybe you can dig around. I don't know, but he was just looking around. And he always wanted to go there. He was excited to go check the place out. And he found it, and it's a 7.44 carat diamond. It's the color of coffee, which is interesting. I don't know what it's worth. They didn't say, and he said he wanted to keep it. Yeah, right. For now you do. Unless you could sell it, then I would sell it. The number of diamonds found in the park this year is 97, just this year. Mm. And you think about it, I mean, we're only in March.
Yeah.
There's a good chance you might find something. Like and a lot of them are smaller, so they're probably not, I don't know, that valuable. But if you find it, you can keep it. And this guy found a 7.44 carat diamond. So I've been itching to go there just to look around. And how disappointed will I be if I do and I don't find anything? I'm expecting diamonds.
Well, Grant and I, a former class member for our college, he just got engaged and he lives in Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
So I was thinking of going there and getting him a wedding gift.
Oh,
so it'd be perfect.
Smart.
I tell you what, I know you're kind of kidding around, but I mean, what would it hurt to at least try, right?
Yeah.
Go there and look around, and if you find something nice, you could just have it set and be like, here you go. I should have done that years ago when I was getting married.
Take your week vacation and go out and put some work in every day and see if you can actually more than make the money back.
Yeah. Well, you know, what would happen though, you'd come back and, you know, you'd show your fiance there and be like, is this big enough, you think? Or keep looking. I don't know if somebody would want a coffee colored diamond. That's kind of interesting. I mean, because they're priced based on like carat cut, color, clarity. I mean, there's a whole list of things. So I don't know if this would be like awesome because it's unique or if it wouldn't be higher standard. I'm not sure.
Well, I imagine most diamonds wouldn't get you that much, and that because a diamond, when it's found, looks like a rock made of glass. Like it just looks like a nice rock. So they get it. Yeah, they have to get it cut, which can be expensive, and then get it set and that kind of thing. So I'm not sure it would yield that much. I think that's why they're so willing to say, oh, you can keep what you find, because they've probably already found all the nice stuff.
Probably. I think, if I remember correctly, years ago they found somebody found a huge one. But yeah, even if it wasn't worth much, it'd still be neat to say, hey, I found this. So I was thinking, if I worked there, you would be like looking every day, wouldn't you? Kind of just like peeking around. And
yeah, definitely.
Seeing. What if somebody lost their diamond ring and you found it there? Hey, I don't know. I found it. It's in the diamond park.
It just happens to be an entire developed diamond ring, though.
It's a whole wedding set. Yeah, I don't know. They're coming out of the ground. So that's kind of interesting. Might be a fun trip over there in Arkansas, Crater of Diamonds State Park. So they found 90, already found almost 100 this year, 97.
Wow.
Of course, this one's happening. A listener sent this in. This is a really weird story. It's like it's a good example of how man is. You know, we do really bad things, and then we try to do good things to balance them out, but it doesn't quite make sense. U.S. Army, this is from Fox News, U.S. Army asked for biodegradable ammo. So ammunition with the intent of killing people, right, because it's war, or at least subduing an enemy, but then they want it to be biodegradable. it's a weird thing. They say sourcing the seeds for use in this new ammunition won't be a problem, as the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory already bio-engineered them, this ammo, so that, or the seeds or whatever they're using, so as not to germinate for several months, allowing time for the materials containing them to sufficiently biodegrade, and then the seeds can take up any remaining contaminants as they grow, further reducing harm to the environment. It's weird. It's just, like, I understand that it might help the environment, sort of, but you could just not have war. That seems like a better idea. I know that's not a big option for the world right now, but doesn't that just seem like such a strange thing to try to do?
Yeah, it's like they're concerned about possibly littering with all the shells hitting the ground, but obviously there's going to be bodies on the ground too. Those are the things to worry about.
Well, I think if, because I saw the story earlier, I think if I understand it correctly, the shell casing is biodegradable when you put it into like an artillery piece. It fires off the shell inside the casing, then you have the casing left, and that's what's biodegradable.
Oh,
okay. I think. Because the shell itself explodes and there's nothing left of it anyway.
But the case, yeah. So the casing is made out of.
Yeah.
So the casing is made out of these, like,
yeah, so the
seed material.
Yeah, because the artillery explodes and it's ordnance and it will be destroyed anyway. But the casing is what's left over. During, like, the wars, there's always huge mounds of, like, metal casings.
Okay, I got
it. So I think that's what they want to be biodegradable. Not the stuff that's left over afterwards rather than the combat. Hopefully this isn't too crass or put it this way, but war does create biodegradable material anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because it kills living things. So to me, it just seems like a waste of money to try to fight climate change when we need to end war. Because that's the real threat to humanity. It's not the pollution from war.
Right. Yeah, as if you'd feel better about what happened at a battle scene because the casings are... Well, don't worry, those will biodegrade.
Yeah.
Yeah, really interesting. Well, that makes a little more sense. It was worded oddly for me anyway, and I thought, so where are these, how do these seeds play into it? But it's in the casings.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's how I understand it. It could be, but when I read it, I think that's what it means.
Okay. Well, that makes a little more sense. Because, there's some website out there where they kind of make fun of these different types of things. And they had some fictitious quotes in there from people. And it was interesting looking at, you know, people that are being attacked. Like, well, we're glad that, you know, after the battle's over, there'll be an orchard here. You know, it's just such a strange thing to try to do. It's like trying to do something good on the heels of doing the worst thing you could do. It's just an odd thing. So
yeah, it'd be interesting to find out if maybe those casings are less expensive or they're more effective. Because at least in those ways, you could actually justify it a little bit if you're at least saving money or doing the job better. If you're just focused on, climate change, which a lot of people disagree is a huge problem, then it doesn't seem worth it.
Yeah, really interesting. So technology, but again, not solving the underlying problems of what you need the technology for, I guess. Kia David program is coming up here in a bit on KPCG and on thetrumpet.com. It's there. You can watch it also on television this weekend. It's a new program. Mystery of the Angels and Evil Spirits, from talking about Mystery of the Ages, that book that's free at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you stop and listen to that coming up throughout the weekend here on KPCG, or again, watch the video online at thetrumpet.com or on television this weekend. Grant, you've got an interesting write-up here for us. This is from the New York Times. How to have a more engaging conversation in everyday life.
Yes. Well,
followed by silence.
Just so ironic there.
Yeah,
there's a few experts quoted in this article, and each one of them kind of specializes in some way with communicating with strangers, whether it's bringing people together in this app, maybe like some sort of a friend app, something like that, and then someone else who spends a lot of time in coffee shops and at these jazz bars, because he's actually writing a book about jazz. And then, so obviously he'd meet a lot of strangers there. And then another guy who has his own pickup basketball league that he's started up. So basically strangers coming together and just kind of how to interact with them.
Yeah. And so they've got, from their experiences, they've got some ideas about the best way to have engaging conversations.
Right. And the obvious first point is to unite around a common interest. So for example, if you're in a coffee shop already, you know, a lot of those people are going to be reading books or studying something, and you could see what the book is and make a comment on that. Although, the caveat, a lot of people probably won't want to have a conversation, so you might want to try and gauge that as well before you just barge in.
That's always the dicey thing. Yeah, what you're reading there, you know, none of your business.
I just thought maybe these points could be more easily applied to people we already know, though, instead of, you know, forcing a conversation on a complete stranger who wants no part of it. Although my father's really good at just talking with anyone in public, and it's kind of like his Oklahoman trait. Even though he's from New York, he can just talk to strangers pretty well.
Yeah, so yeah, they have that thing they call stranger danger. You're always like, I don't know who this is, so I'm going to be a little leery here. But like you say, you can you can use maybe some of these tips just in your everyday life with people you do interact with, because it's very common to interact with people but not really have much of a conversation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just, hey, how's it going? And move on. So.
Yeah, so uniting around a common interest is usually pretty easy because you're going to be in the same place. You know, if you're at a basketball game together, you can talk about that pretty easily. That's not really too difficult, and that's kind of a way to start the conversation. Even if you might not have anything else in common, what you're both doing at the time is the same.
Yeah, sports is always probably a big one for guys where you can, you know, talk about the local sports team or something. And most people kind of are into that or have an opinion or like you say, whatever the case might be. If you're at a jazz place, people probably have an interest in jazz, I'm guessing. Mm. So there might be something of value that you could talk about there.
Right. Actually, one of these ladies is pretty funny because she says whenever she goes into a room full of strangers, sometimes she doesn't really have any way to gauge what their profession is or what they're interested in. So she just goes to the group of people who look like her the most. And she finds that she can actually have a conversation with those people pretty easily.
That's profiling.
I know it is. That's what I thought was
conversation
so funny
profiling.
About it. But I mean, I guess if you look the same, maybe you've had some similar experiences. Probably not, but there's a chance.
Yeah, if you're in the same age range or whatever, you probably have some mm-hmm. cultural touchstones that you could maybe talk about a little bit. Of course, with Abraham's example, Canadians are always friendly. So, for the most part. So you guys just have a natural conversation gene, I think.
Yeah, well, I think our natural form of conversation, breaking the ice, is to apologize for something. So immediately people like us. They're like, right. Wow, that guy will apologize for everything.
That's very true. And also in Canada, when you break the ice to start a conversation, you literally have to break the ice.
Yeah.
So it's because it's so cold.
No, you literally pick up the smallest person and throw them on the ice and break it.
And then apologize.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
What other tips do they have for us here, Grant?
Well, the second point is pretty obvious, but it's just to be friendly, open, and polite. Something that's commonly overlooked now is the social construct of just having good manners in public. You would be surprised how much maybe that is not upheld, because I commonly am around people in public who are just cursing, or they're throwing their trash everywhere on the ground when there's another trash can like 50 feet away. Things like that obviously no one wants to be around you, and you're going to repel a lot of friends if that's their first impression of you.
Yeah, that does go a long way. We were watching this video the other day about just a sports guy. He was talking about actually how to get along at a workplace. It was kind of interesting. He had some good points, I thought. And that was kind of the takeaway, was be a nice person. People mm-hmm. enjoy that. as foreign as that sounds, being nice is a good thing.
Yeah, he was even talking about how you can have the greatest statistics ever in football, and yet people won't vote you into the Hall of Fame because you were a jerk to some of your teammates. So it just goes to show that being nice a lot of the time, and that's kind of also what we talked about yesterday, is so important. It's almost more important than actually accomplishing things sometimes.
Yeah, I think there's probably a drop-off in what would be considered common courtesy, and a lot of it has to do probably with the technology, the smartphones and that, or people get so zoned in on their what they're looking at or what they're thinking about that they don't notice the person that is struggling to get the door, or the fact that they're talking loudly on their phone and everyone else is being disturbed by it. You know, you see those things, and it's just common courtesy stuff that maybe isn't as prevalent as it used to be.
Right. And this point, you know, being friendly, open, and polite, there are a lot of giveaways to if you're doing that or not, but being friendly, obviously, you know, smiling, being open. If you're not making eye contact with the person you're talking to and you're just looking at the wall, then obviously there's kind of like there's an invisible barrier there. Being polite, opening doors for people, like you said, putting other people's needs ahead of your own, that really goes a long way toward even developing lifelong friendships.
Yeah, looking at people, that's always a challenge, for kids especially. Yeah. I was talking to my kids. I'm like, "Who are you talking to? Because you're looking at the wall, but you're talking to me. Is there somebody over there?" I just got to give them a hard time about it.
Right. That's always some of the funniest stories you tell.
Yeah. It's everybody's got those where you're just befuddled. Like, who are you talking to?
You know, your son's telling you about his day, and you're like, what's going on?
Who are you
over
talking
here?
To? Yeah, kids a lot of times will do. They're doing six things at one time. You know, mm-hmm. they're talking to you, but they're looking somewhere else, and then they're hopping on one leg and grabbing their shoe and
putting their fingers in their mouth.
And you're just like, what? Why is any of this happening? Just tell me the one thing you want to tell me.
Actually, that leads perfectly into the third point, which is don't overthink it. So that actually might kind of apply there as well. Don't try to make it like it's some complicated project that you're approaching. It's just another human being. Human beings have a lot of similar experiences, and it's not like this other person is a locked safe that you have to try to crack.
Right. Yeah, it can be tough sometimes because if you put too much pressure on yourself, you end up just not doing a great job. You know, like, I got to think of the perfect thing to say or whatever. And then you put too much pressure there, mm-hmm. and it can get awkward. So it is good just to not overdo it, not overthink it.
Right. And it does seem like smooth transitions help as well. You know, obviously, breaking the ice when you're in a group of people, whether you're familiar with them or not, just sort of, you know, mentioning how nice and sunny it is outside or something like that. And then if you're at some activity together, just say, like, you guys have plans after the game, whatever it is, and then you can kind of go from there instead of it being awkward and then you cut it off when you leave.
Yeah, it's a huge life skill. I mean, it'd be easy enough to kind of look at this and be like, oh, okay, that's nice. But, I mean, it's a huge life skill being able to talk to people. Mm. For employment, for anything. And so it is really good to look at those points. Maybe just recap those three for us real quick.
Oh, sure. The first one, let's see. I'm scrolling up. The first one, unite around a common interest. The second one, be friendly, open, and polite. And the third one is don't overthink it.
Yeah, those are great. Those are great to apply and very helpful in conversations. So that's a write-up from the New York Times, how to have more engaging conversations in everyday life. That's a life hack. Brought mm-hmm. to you by Grant Turgeon. Very important. Grant, thanks for bringing that article to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio live here on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm, too. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. And you can email us if you'd like to. Comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate those. Get some stories that come in from time to time. And other general comments. We appreciate that. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. At KPCG-FM. We have a kind of an interesting story here. This is a really good one. One of our very own here from the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College, where there's also the Imperial Academy schools. Imperial Academy senior Caleb Hirma won a writing contest for the state of Oklahoma. So he's the Oklahoma champion. And Abraham and I sat down with him yesterday to talk about his essay. And we've got that interview for you now. And pretty interesting, Caleb Hirma, who won this writing contest for the state of Oklahoma. We have a special guest today in the studio, Caleb Hirma, 18-year-old senior at Imperial Academy, which is the school here on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College. Welcome into the studio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And we've got you here because you've done something good. It's better than being here for doing something bad. You wrote an essay. And you won the state competition for that writing project, and now you are entered in the national competition. So maybe you could go ahead and tell us what the assignment was and a little bit about what you wrote.
Okay, so this was an essay where I had to write about some aspect of United States history, early United States history specifically, so I could pick a person or some kind of historical event to write about. And I chose mine. I chose to write about James Monroe in my essay.
James Monroe, that name is familiar, yet probably not that familiar for most people. It's a president, mm-hmm. obviously, but it's not like Abe Lincoln or George Washington. What made you think James Monroe?
He's done a lot of amazing things for the country. He's, I think, in some ways probably the most qualified person to hold the office of president. Prior to being president, he had over 50 years of political experience as well as military experience. He served as a soldier in the American Revolution as well. So he really had a fantastic background that really helped prior to coming to the presidency. And then once he became president, he really presided over an era of good peace and good fortune within the United States, and the time when he was president was known as the era of good feelings because of some of the prosperity that was around in the United States.
Yeah, we definitely would not be considered in the time of good feelings right now in the U.S. So no. that was definitely a different time back then. And so in this essay, did you just focus on the history of Mr. Monroe and his presidency and why he was successful, or did you have a different angle with it?
So I did mainly focus on his life. I started from the beginning. It's just a biographical essay, and I had a very short amount of space, so I only covered some of the main points within his life.
How long was it supposed to be, and how long did it end up being?
I think there was a word count. I don't remember, to be honest, but mine was about 3 written pages, so,
yeah,
you know, about 2,000 words, something like that.
Yeah, enough time to get into your subject, but not a full-on biography, mm-hmm. right,
yeah.
as you would read. Abraham is kind of the historical buff around here. Anything about Monroe that you want to add to this or ask Caleb?
But yeah, with James Monroe, I think almost everyone remembers him for the Monroe Doctrine, the mm-hmm. famous foreign policy declaration during his presidency. So while you were researching it and writing about it, did you find anything that impacted his thinking on why him and his administration did that, and maybe some other of his contemporaries who helped him be a successful president?
Yeah, well, obviously, America in the previous administration under James Madison had just gone to war with Britain in the War of 1812, and so they... And there's this constant quarrel in the period before that of aligning themselves with Britain and aligning themselves with France. They're just flip-flopping back and forth. And so I think Monroe saw that this is causing a major problem, because at the time the European powers did not see them as a power, because America was just a young nation. And so they were using America in a lot of situations. And so I think his decision in pursuing the Monroe Doctrine was the idea that obviously it was about if we pull out of, don't be involved in European affairs at all, we'd like all of the Europeans to just stay out of America and America's backyard, being North and South America. He was trying to demand the European powers to quit colonizing the Americas. And at the time, America didn't really have the power to back up what they were saying, but it formed an ideology that was kind of followed by several previous presidents as America began to emerge to a world power.
When you did your research and wrote this assignment, did you learn anything about James Monroe that surprised you, that you didn't know before?
He was actually the closest president to being elected unanimously other than George Washington. So George Washington was elected unanimously in the Electoral College, and James Monroe had all but one electoral vote when he was elected. There was one, and the one electoral vote was actually supposed to be given to him, but we saw an example of what's called a faithless elector, somebody who doesn't vote for who they're supposed to, and he ended up voting for John Quincy Adams instead. So he almost won a perfect election, which was something I thought was kind of interesting, and I mean, we've never seen since George Washington.
Yeah, you think about this past election where it took forever to figure out who actually won because they kept counting the votes. In that instance of James Monroe, you'd know about, 20 minutes in? He's got them all except for one. So you would know, mm-hmm. which is pretty fascinating.
What political party was he with, and who is he running against, if you can recall?
He was from the Democratic-Republican Party, which at the time there was two main political parties, the Democratic-Republican Party and the Federalist Party. And the Democratic-Republican Party, I would say, is probably closer in ideology to the Republican Party of today. They're big on states' rights and things like that, and a limited government, as opposed to the Federalists, who wanted a big government. And at the time, the Democratic-Republicans had won the election for the past 20 years or so. So the Federalist Party was falling apart, I believe. He was running against Rufus King, was the name of the Federalist candidate, and because the party was just collapsing, he obviously didn't get enough popular support.
You don't know, you don't hear a lot of guys named Rufus. That's not a name you hear a lot of anymore. It's an old-timey name. Well, now on to the good stuff. So you won. You won mm-hmm. a prize. What did you want to tell us what you won?
Well, for winning the state of Oklahoma, the prize was $200, which I was quite happy with.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, I've now been entered into the national competition, which has a first prize of $5,000,
should
I win. So,
yeah,
that's exciting.
And that, and when is the announcement as far as the winner of the national?
The national winner will be announced in June or July, so I should find out by then, which
is yeah. It. Is there, if you, let's say you do go on and win, we'll dream big here, besides, because with the state one, you also get a chance to go to the there's a reception, I believe, some kind. If you win the national one, is there something similar? Do you get to go to a...
Yeah, and I believe the, for the national one, the convention is in Tennessee, and they pay for all the expenses for the trip, which is nice as well, so...
Yeah, that would be tremendous. Talking with Caleb Herma here, who has won the state contest for writing a biographical essay of James Monroe. How many people win on the state level? Is it just one? Are you the only, or are there several that win?
There's only one winner for each state, and then nationally, there's three prize winners, so three people who will win a prize and prize money with a first, second, and third place.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you're the Oklahoma champion.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get you like a championship belt you can wear around. No, that's amazing. Caleb Herma, from a student here, a senior, 18 years old, from Imperial Academy on the campus here of Herbert W. Armstrong College, winner of the state contest for Oklahoma for biographical essay on James Monroe. Congratulations, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Pretty cool that Caleb Herma won that. And it's nice to say you won something on any level, but
yeah,
it's state level. That's pretty sharp. So congratulations to him, and hope he does well on the national level. If he does, we'll have to come back and talk to him again and see how that goes. But that's pretty neat. You ever win anything, Abraham?
No, not even close.
Yeah, I can't think of, you know, yeah, I can't. I don't want to go down that road, I guess.
I won stuff for sports,
yeah,
and for, like, just academics and that kind of thing, but I've never won like a writing contest or anything like that.
Yeah, that's pretty neat to do that. So congratulations to him. And there's a lot going on here with North Korea over the last few years, right? But especially in the last, since the Trump administration has come in, I suppose. And there's a headline here just to wrap up today. It's from the Korea Herald. And they say, talking about the relationship between the U.S. and North Korea, they say, with Washington taking a North Korea policy overhaul, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on Friday declared that the existing strategic patience approach is over, saying all options, including military action, are on the table. So no more strategic patience. And Abraham, you want to take a look at some of the diplomatic history between the United States and North Korea?
Yeah, I think North Korea is always in the news for one reason or the other, and especially I think in the last 20 years, there's been a lot more revelations on how the people inside North Korea live, with people escaping prison camps, coming to the United States, and just revealing this, the horrid conditions and just the brutality of that regime. And so with Rex Tillerson's announcement here, I think a lot of people like it, that finally the era of strategic patience is over. And this dates all the way back to the 1950s. When in the Korean War, the American government settled for half-communist Korean Peninsula. And so this is really the first major change of policy ever since, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, I think in a very significant way. And the most significant diplomatic transactions with North Korea have been about their nuclear program. And the main man who did that was Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton. So since 1950 onward, it was actually the Soviet Union that helped, that gave North Korea nuclear technology and really helped them along. And then China is the main one that helps them with their economy and basically protects them from American invasion. Because North Korea's military is, they have Soviet weapons, but they're very weak. I mean, the combined U.S.-South Korean army could probably overwhelm them very easily. Not without losses, but very quickly if they wanted to. But the main threat against that, or the main drawback, is what will China do? Will there be another war against China like Douglas MacArthur ran into, or what? So, but the main threat, North Korea, they could ignore it because it wasn't a big deal. Small little country wasn't causing trouble until they got nuclear weapons. And that's when, I believe, in 1993, President Bill Clinton they were trying to negotiate with North Korea about a nuclear deal with North Korea that basically would end their nuclear program. They would get nuclear technology, but like peaceful nuclear technology. And then it was a 10-year deal, and at the end of the 10 years, North Korea was supposed to be nuclear-free or nuclear bomb-free, and they couldn't test ballistic missiles or anything. That sounds a little familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, right.
The Iran deal.
Yeah, exactly, and I think that's been brought up, you know, by quite a few commentators that with all the talk about the Iran deal, we have a pattern already. We already saw that happen with North Korea, and it ended horribly. And now there's a lot of thought out there that North Korea is actually helping Iran with their nuclear program as well. So, and it's always interesting when you have a nation like, say, an Iran or a North Korea, and they say, well, we want it for peaceful purposes. What did they ever do in those nations for peaceful purposes? Right? Like that would just be an interesting question to think about a little bit. The idea would be what? That it would help the people, it would bring power to their homes and so forth. What about those regimes puts the interests of the people, the common man, first, historically within that regime? I can't think of one example in Iran or in North Korea, where that, especially like, say, in North Korea, where people are having a very, very difficult time if they're not maybe in the military, I guess. And even then, it's interesting. So they never put the interests of their people first, and then they say, oh, but we want this technology. And so what we saw in North Korea and what we continue to see there, obviously it's the same pattern of what we're seeing in Iran. But then it does get to this interesting point where, okay, if the U.S. says, we're going to go and no more strategic patience, we're going to do something about it, you're kind of forcing the real powers to come out, potentially, yep. Which is China in that case, or with Iran, I guess it'd be Russia to some extent. You've got these sort of frontline players, if you want to think of the game of chess. you've got your pawns out in front that are, you know, bothering the superpowers, but behind it you've got the real power that's allowing these things to continue. And that, I guess, is the danger, right? If you push on that pawn, what's behind it?
Yeah, exactly. That's the real strategic issue here with North Korea. North Korea itself, most people think of as a joke. It's not, or they're not a real threat existentially to any nation, and even their nuclear technology is rather limited, even though it still is a threat. But the main problem is China, especially. And I think if we look at the broad scope of the Cold War history, including our modern era here today, I think we can see that America waited too long to deal with North Korea. And what is furthermore is America was never willing to really deal with the problem of North Korea, which is China. That's the problem here. And that goes all the way back to the Korean War, that history, where when Chinese 200,000 Chinese troops attacked MacArthur's army, Americans were pushed back, and Truman never gave MacArthur a mandate to attack the Chinese, to attack across the Chinese border, and basically was willing to allow the Chinese troops to attack him, push the Americans back, and have a compromise. So that very sentiment that America will not provoke China, we're not willing to go into conflict with China, set the precedent for a whole Pacific strategy ever since. And now that China has nuclear weapons, now that North Korea has nuclear weapons, we've waited too long to where if a struggle with China begins over North Korea, it's not just going to be conventional. It could even be a nuclear war. And that's I think, in hindsight, is a great mistake America has made. And I think everyone agrees that North Korea does need to be taken down. Terrible regime. They oppress their own people. Like, most people don't even have electricity in the basics of life. And then their leaders have been madmen. They've been have mental instability, and they have nuclear weapons. So it's a problem the United States created by our lack of will to fight against China. I mean, that would have been a terrible war. It would have been a very costly one. But in hindsight, it probably would have been worth fighting, because now we have the prospect of a nuclear war in front of us today. So, yeah, I think it's a good thing that the Trump administration is taking a harder line on North Korea. But unfortunately, it's a much tougher strategic situation I think anyone can solve because of all the nuclear weapons in play.
Yeah, and it's difficult because if as soon as, like we saw in Iraq, when the U.S. went in there, you have people crying about the humanitarian side of things. And, you know, there's some concern there, but you're going against a dictator that cares very little or nothing for his own people, and you don't know what he's capable of. In Saddam Hussein's case, he ran and he hid in a rat hole. Okay, but in some other cases, maybe in North Korea's case, maybe they do detonate, you know, a nuke or something because they have nothing to lose. He knows he can't. I would think he would know he can't win if he's. I don't know how clear thinking he is over there in North Korea, but you know, almost nothing to lose, and so that is a dangerous situation to get into because if they do have those weapons and they're willing to use them and they don't care about their own people, it's going to be a tough deal. Because it's going to be mass casualties one way or the other.
Yeah, and it'd just be in an already volatile region with China obviously being imperialistic, Russia there, Japan and the Philippines moving towards China as well. And Russia, you have, if America did go to war, they have very limited allies there. And then you're also fighting against a Chinese army that is much bigger than it used to be, a navy which dominates all the coastal region around Korea, and it can even involve Japan fighting against Korea, and so Japan could become a military power fighting a war. So you have all the. It's not just about North Korea and China. It's a wider scope of strategy to where if you, it's like lighting a tinderbox and you don't exactly know what's going to happen. You could lose all your alliances in the Pacific. You could lose your whole fleet. You could lose all these things in the process, so it just could be a very risky situation. It's good they're being strong because they do need to be strong against North Korea, but I'm not sure if they have the actions to back up their words.
Right, and we're very fractured as a country, so people don't get behind causes very much anymore. And the military that you might draw on, people-wise, maybe a little dicey there as for where you're going to get into the military if it came to that. They would probably think of something more like a strategic strike, I would imagine. I don't imagine they'd want to get into a ground situation. You know, I think Israel's done a pretty good job over the years of just not saying anything, and all of a sudden, Syria's nuclear factory's gone.
Yeah.
So I think they've done a good job with that, and maybe that's probably what they're thinking more of, I would think, would be strategic strike, get in, get out, try to get rid of their weapons capabilities as much as possible and move on. And they could potentially do that. Although, again, we haven't had a lot of success in those things lately.
Yeah, well, and the South Korean army is very capable. So I don't think the U.S. Army would be afraid of that. I think what they're afraid of would be Chinese retaliation, even economically. Because if China starts to sell their bonds, American debt bonds, the American economy could collapse too. So, and then also, even for strategic strikes, the U.S. president would need the approval of Congress, probably, since I think Congress wants that prerogative back.
You could do that with an executive order.
Well, presidents have done that, but it's not constitutional.
Right.
So he would even need the Congress to approve that anyway. So there's a lot of checks and balances, and who knows what will even happen. But I think the big thing they're afraid of is Chinese economic retaliation, because if America might destroy North Korea, but then the American economy might be gone too, and that's terrible.
A lot of good write-ups at thetrumpet.com about North Korea and what's going on over there, a couple of them. One is titled, Who Will Reshape North Korea? That's by Brad McDonald from a few years back. Japan, North Korea, Closer, North Korea Reshaping Asia. China Blocks UN Report on North Korea, which is a good one. Shows you China's involvement, and there's a whole list of them there. If you just go to thetrumpet.com and you can search on Korea, you can find North Korea. You can find a whole lot of really good articles about that. It'll give you some good insight into what's happening over there in that region and what you can expect to see happen. Also, make sure you listen for the Key of David program that's coming up here this weekend on KPCG. The program this week, Mystery of the Angels and Evil Spirits. Very interesting topic, I think, for a lot of people. Topic people don't know a lot about. It says, wars are killing tens of thousands of people around the world every year, yet the most important war of all goes unseen. Discover how spiritual armies are fighting for control of human minds. Sounds like a movie, but it's interesting when you look into what the Bible says about it. Mystery of Angels and Evil Spirits. You can check that out at the Key of David program. Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. Make sure you listen for that. Also, the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program is coming up in a little bit. And stop and check out thetrumpet.com. Top story today, pornography scandal rocks U.S. military by Andrew Miller. And that is something that has been in the headlines quite a bit lately. And so make sure you check that out at thetrumpet.com. Always dicey when there's different genders there in the military together, and there's been some problems because of it.
Yeah, it's I think what we're seeing, I think as Mr. Miller brings out, is that military is just a mirror of the society it comes from. And when you have pornography and those problems with men and women and sharing pictures online, all that stuff outside the Army, when those same individuals enter the Army, it doesn't matter what the ethos is of the Marine Corps or any other unit, the dignity and the morals they're supposed to have, they're going to bring in what they are. And that's what we're seeing, is where we're just seeing the general immorality of some parts of American society bring down the ethics of the fighting force.
Yeah, so that's that is a major, major issue there. You can read more about that at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you do check that out. It's a new and improved site in a lot of ways. That's at the thetrumpet.com. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live and for this week. Thanks for joining us, spending some time with us. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau, enjoy your weekend. Have a great one. And we'll see you back here on Monday. You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.